Welcome to this second part of a two-part series featuring the winners of the Annisville Wolf Awards to be held in Cleveland on September 13th. This week we'll be speaking with American biographer Arnold Rampersad and David Livingston Smith. David Livingston Smith was born in New York City and grew up in South Florida. He moved to London in 1976, where he continued his education and became a psychoanalytic psychotherapist and director of the master's program in psychotherapy and counseling at Regent's College. He earned a PhD in philosophy at the University of London, where he did work on the philosophy of mind and philosophy of psychology. These studies introduced him to the significance of evolutionary biology for understanding human nature. Moving from the United Kingdom in 2000, he took up a position at the University of New England, where he teaches a range of courses on philosophy. In 2001, he became a co-founder and director of the New England Institute for Cognitive Science and Evolutionary Studies. The institute was designed to explore the interface between evolutionary biology and human nature. In his latest work, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, Smith explains the phenomena of dehumanization and our peculiar tendency to treat groups of people as subhuman animals as a prelude and accompaniment to extreme violence. He explains the features of human psychology that make dehumanization possible and argues that research in dehumanization should be made a priority if we want to prevent repeats of atrocities like those that occurred in Auschwitz, Rwanda, and Hiroshima. David, welcome to WBAI and Pacifica Radio. David, you begin in your preface with an excerpt of the U.S. Declaration of Independence and the premise of, quote, all men being created equal. Yet the signing of this document took place as Africans were captured and enslaved. How do you account for this difference between words and deeds?
When we say people, we have to ask what we mean. And, what is a human being? And if we look at this historically, we find that that those who use that word very often didn't use it to include all members of our species. Now, you might ask, well, why is that? And the reason for that, I think, is that when we exclude others from the category of the human, we exclude them from the moral universe, as we have fewer moral obligations to them, and it's often very advantageous for one group of people to harm or to exploit another group of people.
David, why is it important to investigate dehumanization, and how has it evolved historically?
If we look at the record of human atrocity, of course, the picture is pretty grim. We human beings do terrible, terrible things to our own kind. And one of the very regular accompaniments to these acts of atrocity, and this goes way, way back in the historical record, is thinking of those that we do violence to as subhuman creatures. That permits us, and sometimes when we conceive of them as dangerous creatures, it places sort of a what we imagine to be an obligation on us to harm them, to kill them, to exterminate them, and so on. Now, I think that's really, really important, because what this mechanism does is it liberates violence, it liberates aggression. It allows human beings to do things to others that, if they considered them full-fledged human beings, they have great difficulty bringing themselves to do. So if we are really serious about preventing genocide and preventing atrocity and preventing violence on a mass scale, this is something we really, really need to understand. We need to study it. We need to see how it works, and we need to work out as best we can how to prevent it.
Tell us about the dehumanization of indigenous people in the, quote, New World.
Well, of course, from the beginning, from Columbus's first voyage, Native Americans were brutalized and exterminated. They were worked to death. They were owned as slaves. It was really quite horrible. And this was justified eventually quite a, I mean, and initially it was justified by simply treating them as and conceiving of them as non-human creatures. And eventually there were fancier justifications. So the Spanish argued that the Native Americans were what Aristotle called natural slaves. So this was an old doctrine. You know, the ancient Greeks of Aristotle's period, they thought there were two kinds of beings, two kinds of people, really. There were Greeks, and there was everyone else, and everyone else was a barbarian. Barbarians weren't quite seen as subhuman, but they were seen as defectively human and natural slaves. That is, the Greeks thought that, and at least Aristotle thought that, the destiny of barbarians was to be subjugated, that that was good for them, as it were. And so this doctrine was revived with the Spanish conquest of the New World and the genocide of Native Americans. It was revived to justify this sort of barbaric treatment. In fact, in 1550, there was a debate between a man named Bartolomé de las Casas and a scholar named Sepulveda, and this debate essentially turned on whether or not American Indians were human beings, whether they had human souls.
On a theological level, how did the church justify, and those who followed the church, how did the church justify this kind of dehumanization?
Well, eventually the church made a good showing, actually. I mean, it was... Las Casas was inspired by a priest who preached against the Spanish barbarities, a Spanish priest. And he himself was a priest, and he himself influenced the Pope, who issued a pronouncement saying these are human beings with souls and should be treated as such. So, you know, officially, the church made a fairly decent showing there, but of course, one of the unfortunate characteristics of our species is that there's often, as you mentioned earlier, a big gap between what we say and what we do.
Slavery, of course, did not begin with the American form. What is the history of slavery as it relates to dehumanization?
Okay, well, the origins of slavery are lost in the mist of time, but it's probably around 10,000 years old. That is, slavery probably began around the time that our ancestors settled down in sedentary lifestyle and discovered agriculture and so on and so forth. Slaves were initially prisoners of war. This persisted, you know, for a very long time. If we go back to some of the early traditions in a variety of cultures, the treatment of slaves, we find them characterized as not quite human. And this is, of course, a way to justify slaves' exploitation. I mean, you don't do to fellow human beings what people did, and by the way, still do, to slaves. It's not widely known that there are more slaves in the world now than ever before in human history. So, slavery was intimately tied to dehumanization. I mean, we can see this both in the trans-Saharan slave trade and in the transatlantic slave trade and in the enslavement of Native Americans. In fact, here we can bring in theology and the church again. One of the justifications for enslaving Africans and Native Americans was the claim that they were not descendants of Adam and Eve. The Africans were sometimes seen as having been originally formed out of the debris left by the Great Flood, or descendants of Satan, or, you know, something of that nature, which would remove from them a genuinely human pedigree. And of course, if you're not a human being, you don't have a human soul, and you're not worthy of the respect accorded to fellow human beings.
Genocide as slavery is not a recent phenomenon. Using specific examples such as Rwanda, Armenians, and Cambodia, you wrote about the role of dehumanization in genocide. Talk about that.
Yeah, in every case where there are detailed enough records, we find dehumanization in genocide. So the group of people, and this is very important about dehumanization, by the way, dehumanization pertains to groups of people, whole populations. A whole population is seen as less than human. And so in genocide, it's just so regular that those who are being exterminated are not only seen as less than human creatures, but also as dangerous, and typically as disease-carrying organisms or traditionally unclean organisms. I mean, in the Armenian genocide, the Armenians and Greeks who were killed in that genocide were compared to bacilli, disease organisms, dogs, and dogs are, of course, a traditionally unclean animal in the Middle East. We can go back a bit earlier to the Namibian genocide, the genocide of the Herero and Nama, the first genocide of the 20th century. These people.
That was by the Germans, also, eh?
That's right. Yes, that's right. It was a horrible, horrible genocide, and these folks, who have still, by the way, not received any compensation for what was done to them, were described as baboons. In Rwanda, snakes. The persecuted people were described as snakes, cockroaches, hyenas. Of course, in the Holocaust, we find the image of rats used extensively. So we find this over and over again, and particularly with genocide, it's this. The other is seen as a nasty, filthy, disease-carrying organism that needs to be wiped out, that needs to be exterminated. I mean, yeah, that's what you do with rats and cockroaches. You don't kill a rat and hang its head above the mantelpiece. You poison them. You kill them en masse. And so whenever we come across this sort of thinking, this kind of comparison of groups of people to vermin, it's dangerous. It's something we really, really need to pay attention to. And I say that now because this is a sort of imagery which comes up now and again with respect to undocumented immigrants from Latin America.
What is the connection between race and dehumanization?
That's a really, really, really important connection. So we have to ask, really, what race is. And first of all, there are two kinds of notions of race. There's sort of a folk notion, and there's what is nowadays a scientific notion. The scientific notion of race, as it's used nowadays rather than 100 years ago, would be just a notion of a relatively homogeneous, fairly inbred local population. So there are groups of people who might be considered racist in that sense, but they have nothing to do with the way that races are described in popular culture on census forms. So the Amish people, for instance, might be a race in that sense, or some people, say, living on remote islands off the coast of Maine would be races in that sense. The folk notion of race is the idea that there are these groups of people that have a special essence, something that sets them apart from everyone else, and that all members of this group share. And so that's the idea of blacks and whites and Asians and so on. Scientifically, that makes no sense at all. But it's a very, very stubborn idea. And in fact, contrary to what some historians say, it goes back very far. The categories shift over time. And it's very interesting. The way that the categories shift is often a matter of it's determined by social, economic, and political factors. So 150 years ago, the Irish were a race, and Jews were a race, and Germans were a race, and so on and so forth. And there was this panic about the inferior races coming to this country from Europe, incapable of self-government, and so on and so forth. And even more interesting is when we look at U.S. History, when Europeans first came to North America, and there was not much tension between the Europeans and Native Americans. Native Americans were described as white. And as conflict grew, and as there was more and more incentive to do harm to these people, their racial categorization changed. They became described as red, and there were these anti-miscegenation laws put into effect, and so on and so forth. So these categories are really, really flexible. Now, I think that racism is the first step to genocide. You take a group of people, you set them apart, you say they're deeply different, they're other, they're not like us, they're not of my kind, they're a different kind. They have a special essence that makes them different. And then the next step is to conceive of that special essence, that notion of what they are deep down, as something subhuman. So I think racial thinking is really, really dangerous.
Although you didn't cover this specifically, but what about the dehumanization and sexism or homophobia?
Yeah, it's something that I haven't really studied. I think... So when we talk about dehumanization, actually the word is thrown around a lot and has lots of different senses. But sometimes we mean the sort of thing that I'm talking about, so thinking of others as subhuman animals. But sometimes it's thinking of others as objects, of things to be just used and manipulated, not as subhuman animals. That latter process, conceiving of others as objects, goes on a great deal in the dehumanization, or as I would prefer to say, the objectification of women. Homophobia is something I'd really like to study at some point, because I do think that dehumanization is probably rampant in homophobic attitudes, but I need to do the research before I can speak about that with any degree of confidence.
Let's talk about war. Is war strictly a human endeavor?
Actually, I think it is. I mean, there are analogs amongst other species. And probably quite revealingly, the closest analog is with our closest relative, the chimpanzee. So chimpanzees do form groups predominantly of young males who make incursions into the territories of their neighbors and kill them in horribly violent ways. And very interestingly, they treat these other chimpanzees as though they were prey animals. You know, chimpanzees hunt. They eat meat as well as their fruit and vegetables and so on. And they treat these other chimps as though they were, say, colobus monkeys, which is one of the animals that chimpanzees like to hunt. But, you know, and that's interesting. There are relatives. They're like us in many ways. But what they do is, of course, very, very different from war as human beings practice it. I mean, war as human beings practice it is saturated with ideology, with cultural symbolism, with all sorts of other things, and it's also many against many. Whereas amongst chimpanzees, it's more like a gang attacking an individual or a couple of individuals. Now, war is a very horrible thing, which is why it's so often misrepresented. I think if war were portrayed realistically in popular culture, people would be much less keen to participate in it. So we're given lots of illusions, and in the movies, war is usually portrayed as something which is easy to partake in. I mean, in the movies, it's easy to kill. It's easy to kill the bad guys. But in fact, that's not the case. In fact, killing is hard. Unless you're a sociopath, it is very difficult to kill another human being, particularly if up close and personal, looking into another human being's eyes, because that forces us to recognize their humanity, and certain inhibitions just kick in.
So why are we as humans ambivalent towards killing?
Well, if we again consider we don't even have to consider the chimpanzees. Obviously, sadly, but obviously, it is often deeply advantageous for one group of people to exploit, to harm, or to kill another group of people. I mean, if we could return just briefly away from the subject to slavery again. Slavery as practiced in the Americas, it was a highly productive system of labor. People got incredibly rich on the back of slavery. So it was economically advantageous to those who perpetrated it. And the same, of course, is with war. We take people's resources, we expand our territories, and so on and so forth. So there is an attraction, but there's also an inhibition. And that inhibition, the full story is kind of complicated, and I would advise them to read my book to get the full story, as I suspect it is. I mean, these things are all rather speculative. But here's the fact. The fact is that we have natural, deep inhibitions against perpetrating atrocity against our own kind. It's hard to kill. It's hard to do. As soon as we recognize another as of our own kind, certain, I think, ultimately biological inhibitions kick in. And so if that's the case, and you could see that we're kind of between a rock and a hard place. And on one hand, there's an inclination to do violence to others for personal advantage. On the other hand, there's a horror of doing so. And dehumanization is a sort of a gimmick that disables these inhibitions. It allows us, or it helps us, to do these things which, if we couldn't dehumanize others, would be very difficult to do. And that's why we have dehumanization as a very, very common feature of war. The enemy is less than human. They tend not to be seen as filthy, disease-carrying animals like we have in genocide, but more often as dangerous predators, as monsters, as bloodthirsty beasts that need to be killed for our own protection.
Dr. Smith, you've formulated a theory of dehumanization. What is it, and how does it help to perhaps solve the problem of dehumanizing folks?
Okay, so I wish I knew how to solve the problem. Let me start there at the end. The sad fact is, dehumanization is terribly understudied. Although the word is used a lot, there's been very, very, very little serious investigation. I mean, really, very little. And so what I wanted to do in writing the book was sort of put this on the agenda to say to people, look, if we care about having a decent future, if we care about humanity, we really need to understand this, because it's only when we understand the machinery of it properly that we can do something about it, even though, of course, it's often not in the interests of powerful elites for us to do anything about it. You know, our governments want us to go to war, and dehumanization helps that, so on and so forth. So what I tried to do is say, okay, let's have a conversation. Let's look at, first of all, let's gather information from lots and lots and lots of different fields. Every place we can find information on dehumanization, pull it together. Paint a picture, and that shows how important it is. Look at the history of the concept from ancient times to the present. And then what I think most importantly is to try and theorize it. What is it about us that allows us to do this? Because if you think about it, it's very, very strange. I'm ethnically, I'm from a Jewish background. I'm tall, blue-eyed, and when I had hair, it was blonde. A Nazi looking at me and thinking that I'm a subhuman creature, I mean, it's puzzling how a Nazi could do that. I look just like him. And this is true of any human being. I mean, we're bipedal. We stand on two legs. We talk. We wear clothes. We very, very closely resemble one another. So how is it possible? What's going on? And it turns out, I think, that the way this works is through what's called psychological essentialism. We, all of us human beings, have this tendency to think that every kind of thing has an essence, and that essence makes it what it is. Now, this is scientifically, in most spheres, false. So we tend to think, well, what makes a dog a dog? There's some kind of inner dogginess that makes a dog a dog. And what makes a human human is some kind of inner humanness, often described as the human soul or the rational soul or something like that. Now, the idea of essence is different from the idea of appearance, how things look. And we know that just as we have, you know, counterfeit coins that look just like genuine coins but aren't real coins, that would be an example of the way we tend to think about it anyway, is the essence and the appearance of something coming apart. So when we dehumanize this tendency gets exploited. That is, we think, oh yeah, that other looks like a human being, has a human appearance. But we can think to ourselves, but inside, deep down, where it really counts, they are not human. So that's the first picture. Now, what about this? There's another aspect to this, which is the idea of less than human. And this is another really stubborn feature of human psychology. We tend to think of the universe as sort of a hierarchy of value. This is an old idea. It's called the great chain of being. So the idea is that the universe could be, everything in the universe could be classified as occupying some level in between ultimate perfection, which is traditionally God, and ultimate imperfection, which is traditionally nothingness or dirt, inert matter, or something like this. So everything has its place. And we, human beings, humble that we are, placed ourselves just below the angels. So we have a very high opinion of ourselves, and then we tend to think of all the other creatures as falling lower on that hierarchy, as being beneath us, because the idea is that they are less perfect, they are more distant from the ultimate perfection of God, and the less perfect they are, the less moral obligation we have to them. So that gives us the idea of less than human. So if you combine these two elements, they allow us to think of other groups of people as having a non-human essence, and that essence is somehow lower than, beneath humanity.
And last but not least, on September 13th, you'll be receiving the Annisfield Wolf Award for Less Than Human. What are your thoughts about receiving this prestigious award?
It is such an honor. I mean, it's so humbling. I don't. When Skip Gates phoned me up, I couldn't believe it. And, I mean, just the idea that the jury read my book is awesome enough, but that they appreciate it enough to give me this award, it's just wonderful. I'm speechless with gratitude, and I really don't feel that I belong in this in the company of great people like Langston Hughes and Ralph Ellison and David Brian Davis and so on. So it's a tremendous honor.
That was David Livingston Smith, author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. This is the second part of a two-part series on the 2012 winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, to be held in Cleveland on September 13th. Next up, biographer Arnold Rampersad. I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
song was inspired by a poem written by Langston Hughes. I'm sure most of you have heard of Langston Hughes. And he wrote a poem about rivers, and we call this song I've Known Rivers.
Arnold Rampersad is an American biographer and literary critic born in Trinidad and Tobago and is currently professor emeritus at Stanford University. He's an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and of the American Philosophical Society. As a biographer, he has written The Art and Imagination of W.E.B. Du Bois, a two-volume set entitled The Life of Langston Hughes, Days of Grace, a memoir co-authored with Arthur Ashe, biographies on Jackie Robinson and Ralph Ellison, which was awarded the National Humanities Medal and a finalist for the 2007 National Book Award. The first volume of The Life of Langston Hughes was a finalist for the 1986 Pulitzer Prize. In addition, he has edited several volumes, including The Collected Poems of Langston Hughes, The Library of American Edition of Works by Richard Wright, Slavery and the Literary Imagination, Race and American Culture, and Poetry for Young People, Langston Hughes. Dr. Rampersad, welcome to WBAI. On September 13th, you'll be receiving the Annisfield Wolf Award in Cleveland. What are your feelings about this Lifetime Achievement Award?
Well, of course, receiving Lifetime Achievement Awards makes one think of the end, as it were. Well, on the other hand, it's very humbling and welcome to know that an organization as prestigious as the Annisfield Wolf Foundation judges your lifetime work as of being of sufficient merit that it should be honored in some way. So I'm very pleased, humbled, and looking forward to the ceremony.
Your first book, The Art and Imagination of W.E.B. Du Bois, was a monumental work on the life of the author of Souls of Black Folk. Why did you write that book, and where does he stand in the context of American history?
When I was looking for a dissertation topic, I was drawn to Du Bois because The Souls of Black Folk had a tremendous impact on me. This was in the late 1960s, early 1970s. I did not think much of the few books then on Du Bois. I didn't think that he was properly appreciated, the breadth of his imagination and intellect, the depth of his commitment to certain values, including Pan-Africanism and so on. So I decided I would write my own book. The papers were closed at that time, closed to scholars, so I had to write what I call intellectual biography using the material which was then openly available. Where does Du Bois stand? I still think of him as the central African-American intellectual and writer, an important historian whose works have not lost their value at all as time has passed.
10 years later, you wrote the two-volume set on Langston Hughes, an American culture giant. What was it that drew you to this work and inspired you to write his biography?
Well, in part it was accidental, meeting the executive trustee of the Langston Hughes estate, Professor George Houston Bass, who had read my Du Bois book and thought that perhaps I should have a crack at the at writing a biography of Langston Hughes. The papers were then closed to the general public. But I saw the absolute cornucopia of material Langston Hughes had left behind at Yale, I realized that I had an opportunity to delve deeply not only into his life, but into the artistic life of Black American poets and poetry and dramatists and so on, because Hughes was so accomplished in so many fields. And I simply devoted myself to trying to tell, as best I could, the full story of this extraordinary man's life.
What did you find, I guess, extraordinary about it? And again, where does he fit in the sense of American, not only history, but of course, American culture?
Hughes has increasingly been seen as as an extraordinary American literary figure and an extraordinary world literary figure as well in the 20th century. I mean, I tend to see him as being the most important single most important African American poet, but he was also a dramatist and a novelist and a short story writer. So he's also, in some respects, the most representative African American writer. I think increasingly he's been seen as an unusual figure, but one whose commitment to literature, as well as his commitment to African American culture, have put him in a special category where he deserves to be honored by all of us.
Dr. Rampersad, I'm doing a piece on Zora Neale Hurston. Can you tell me about Langston's relationship to Zora from the time they met till the time they, for lack of a better term, broke up?
Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston were kindred spirits, a kind of brother and sister almost in terms of their attitude to Black America and especially to folk culture. They both believed very strongly in blues culture and Southern-based African-American culture, its values, its virtues, at a time when to many African-American poets and writers in general, that culture was really a representative of passé qualities that writers wished to bypass in representing Black American culture. So they had a very lively personal relationship in which they helped one another, and this culminated in their work together on the play Mule Bone, but at the same time, just about at that time, they had a falling out in which Hurston claimed the authorship of the play for herself, when in reality it was a shared experience. It was very unfortunate, an unfortunate break in their relationship that lasted for the rest of their lives. And I think both parties regretted the break, because really they were both extraordinarily talented people who saw African-American culture in very similar ways. And it was to be regretted that they had to part ways, especially concerning the authorship of a play that to which both of them contributed mightily.
Uncle Bud is not a work song. It's a sort of social song for amusement, and it's so widely distributed. It's growing all the time by incremental repetition, and it is known all over the South. No matter where you go, you can find verses of Uncle Bud. And it's the favorite song, and the men get to working in every kind of work, and they just yell down on Uncle Bud, and nobody particularly leads it. Everybody puts in his verse when he gets ready. And Uncle Bud grows and grows and grows. Uncle Bud's a man like this. He can't get a woman, gonna use his fist. Uncle Bud, Uncle Bud, Uncle Bud, Uncle Bud, Uncle Bud. Oh, I'm going to town, gonna hurry back. Uncle Bud's got something I sure do like. Uncle Bud, Uncle Bud, Uncle Bud, Uncle Bud.
Dr. Rampersad, Du Bois, Hughes, and later, of course, you wrote about Richard Wright. All of them had, quote, leftist leanings. How has this shaped African-American culture?
Well, I think it has shaped African-American culture in significant ways. Yes, all of these men did have left-leaning sympathies, although some of them had troubled relationships with the Communist Party itself. I think that they all had tremendously active social consciences. They all had tremendously active intellectual resources, and these combined in a feeling, a special feeling for the kind of analysis of the national, international, and racial problems that the left brought to bear on the American experience. It might be said that he almost repudiated his ties to the far left at a certain point in his life under pressure from the American right. But the truth is that to the very end he remained very much drawn to the socialist position and to radical politics in general.
How did you come to co-author Days of Grace, a memoir with Arthur Ashe, and what were your impressions of him as a person?
Arthur Ashe and I had not known each other very closely. We had met, and I had sent him some of my books because I thought he was admirable for many things, but not least of all because of his involvement in trying to promote literacy and an awareness of literature among young people, particularly young people of color.
This was before he contracted AIDS?
This was before he contracted AIDS. After he contracted AIDS, out of the blue, he called me and said that he wanted to write one more book. Probably it would be his last book, since he had full-blown AIDS by this time. By this time, it had become public. And I agreed at once to work with him on that book. I think very highly, thought very highly of Arthur Ashe, and still think very highly of him. I think as a man with the opportunity to lose himself in the world of pleasure and consumption and so on, it was amazing the way he kept a very serious approach to life, a life... He committed himself to trying to understand society about him, trying to understand African American problems, and trying to take certain positions that were not always very popular, but for which he had a great commitment, a belief in education, a belief in social responsibility. There was a deep seriousness about the man. And a kind of nobility, I think, that is sorely missed right now.
Jackie Robinson, a biography, was your next work. Robinson remains an icon in both sports and as a figure for desegregation in America. What impact did he have on the civil rights movement?
I think he had an enormous impact on the civil rights movement. I think Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. made that abundantly clear time and again. He was a great admirer of Robinson, and he also believed that what Robinson did in 1947 and in the following years in desegregating Major League Baseball provided a kind of model for the nonviolence movement, the civil rights movement that Dr. King himself led in so spectacularly. So the people involved in the movement saw Robinson as a kind of archetypal figure embodying the best principles of nonviolent resistance, but firm resistance nevertheless, and they embraced them, and he embraced them. They embraced him, and he embraced them, and it was a kind of mutual admiration arrangement of society between the civil rights movement as we saw it unfold and Robinson, who had come a bit earlier but was still active in the 1950s and early 1960s.
Your next book was on Ralph Ellison, known for his National Book Award winning novel, The Invisible Man, a book challenging the identity and place in society of the African American. Have African Americans confirmed the identity and place in U.S. society?
Well, I think African Americans have moved decidedly in the direction of confirming their visibility and affirming their dignity and humanity and their power as a group. Of course, problems remain, and I think will always be there. I don't think our society will ever get to that point, that post-racial point that people, some people like to talk about, some people like to assert exists. Maybe in the fullness of time, such we will come to that moment. But in the meantime, I think through the dint of much protesting and asserting and building, African Americans have reached a place in American society that is far different from the place it occupied 30, 40, 50, and certainly 100 years ago.
You also co-authored Slavery and a Literary Imagination. Talk about that.
So that book was co-edited with Professor Deborah McDowell at University of Virginia. And it was a look at the extent to which and the ways in which the phenomenon of American slavery had been had an effect on writers. The Civil War is in many respects the greatest American story, second perhaps only to the American Revolution, and slavery is an important part of that Civil War story, even though it is sometimes downplayed and preferences given to the armed struggle of the South and the North and as battles and so on. But slavery, especially in the works of people, authors such as William Faulkner, but also Toni Morrison, and many, many others, is a mighty theme. And we wanted to look at the ways in which the theme has been explored positively and negatively. And I think we came up with a book that that casts important light on that topic.
You also co-author Race and American Culture. And I just wanted to just follow up on the last question, though. Why do you think the Civil War was one of the two greatest events in American history?
Well, it was extraordinarily divisive. I mean, it was important for African Americans since it was the event, as it were, that led to the downfall of slavery. It was essentially fought over slavery. It was extraordinarily bloody. It was the bloodiest war that the United States has ever taken part in, including the two world wars. The loss of life was amazing. And just the idea of a whole section of the country seeking to secede from the Union. I mean, these are mighty events and themes. So I would stand by that assertion that the Civil War was second only, perhaps, to the American Revolution as a shaper of American culture.
And, of course, following the Civil War was the period of Reconstruction. What are your thoughts about the period itself, but also the aftermath of the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1877, which allowed Jim Crow and Knight Riders and other forms of segregation to come into being?
Well, of course, that was terribly oppressive episode in American history. The aftermath of Reconstruction, the withdrawal of Northern armies from the South, and the reinstitution of racist practices at all levels of society in the South, building up to the to the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision that seemed to enshrine segregation as the law of the land. That was what one historian has called the nadir of African-American history, the lowest point, and I agree with him. And the story of African-Americans resisting oppression, resisting the force of segregationist law, is itself one of the most compelling stories in American history.
But Dr. Rampersad, can you talk about your book, which you co-authored, Race and American Culture?
That was actually a series of books published by Oxford University Press over a number of years. I co-edited that series with Professor Shelley Fisher-Fishkin, who is now at Stanford University in the Department of English. And we were looking at books that had something to say, something special to say, scholarly books for the most part, about the way race impacted American culture. And we saw that problem from a variety of lenses. And I think the series, a number of books, more than a dozen, contributed a great deal, I think, to the understanding of the racial issue in the 1980s and 90s and into our own century.
What are your comments on contemporary American culture?
Well, that's a very broad question. What do you mean in particular?
As far as perhaps racial attitudes or and things like that.
Well, again, as I say, that's a very broad question. I said a while ago that I did not think that that we are living in a post-racial society, as some people assert. I think that racism is very much alive and well, or sick, if that's the proper word. I think African Americans are continually being called upon to face situations, events, conventions that make their lives problematical in so many ways. I think the African Americans have made enormous progress, but I think the culture as a whole, notwithstanding the election of an African American as President of the United States, remains in some respects perilous, and it calls for us to be continually on our guard against the forces out there that would insist on seeing African Americans as less than full citizens of the American Republic.
Dr. Rampersad, I appreciate your time this afternoon, and again, congratulations on winning the Annis Field Wolf Award, and on September 13th, you'll be in Cleveland, I suppose, getting your award.
Thank you very much, as I plan to be there.
That was biographer Arnold Rampersad. And that concludes this special two-part series on the 2012 Annis Field Wolf Book Awards to be held in Cleveland on September 13th. I'm Dred Scott Keyes.